Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today's Thursday, December the 11th. This is episode 3774 of the Survival Podcast. And as it is typical with our schedule, since it's Thursday, it's time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I am content rich right now from the expert counsel. I shook the piker tree pretty hard right after the workshop. And if you're an expert counsel member tuning in today and you know I have content from you, let's say your name is Joel Riles, for instance. I have like five pieces of content and you're not on today's show. That's because everybody sent content in. And I'm trying to keep as much of a mix week to week as I can with getting people on the air that people don't always hear from. I've got some of that today and some of the usual suspects that are heavy with content all the time. For instance, Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul never miss a week unless it's my fault, honestly. Their segment this week is Trump's second term has been a rough go for the American people. I'll agree. I haven't listened to it yet, so I'll listen to it with you. I have my own thoughts on that, and my bigger thing is it doesn't have to be. So why is it? Because there's so much good coming out and so much stupid and so much bad all at the same time. You're like, what are you doing? Sometimes I wonder if that's a strategy or just senility. I don't really know. Matthew Sersley will talk about a new tax form. Oh, yay, joy! Nothing like a new tax form. It's called a 1099 DA. Here's the good news. If you do not own Bitcoin or other digital assets, you won't care. The other good news is if you mostly just hold, it won't really matter. But if you sell at all, this is going to matter. And, of course, the government does everything incompetently before it even gets rudimentarily competent. And Matt Sersley, as you might imagine, will talk about this. I'm going to tell you how clunkily and retarded it was when they rolled out something very similar, the 1099-K, for merchant account providers like PayPal and Stripe and others. And how they created problems for us that we had to handle. And if you have a good CPA who knows how to handle things as they're being worked out, this won't be a big deal. But you need to keep maybe better records than you have in the past. But if you are the person that keeps all your shit on one exchange and does all your sales and trades on one exchange and never takes it off, which is dumb for a variety of reasons, this thing will actually be helpful to you, other than they will make sure that you pay all your taxes. Mike Melito has three questions about hunting rifles, all from one person who very cleverly blended them into what looked like a single question. Andy McCann will talk about the fact 2026 is coming and what you should do for your health and your wealth and your mind and your spirit and your soul going into that new year. Ryan Steva will talk about the ins and outs of small-scale wind energy. This is why when we had a question yesterday at the end of our episode with a gentleman who does a lot with solar off-grid, but doesn't really do anything with wind, even though I had some input, I kept my hole shut because I knew this segment would be here today. And then we're going to have some talks about eliminating roadblocks and end-of-life planning from Nicole Sauce. I'm going to have a short take on end-of-life planning that's probably not the way you've ever heard it before. Nicole's going to talk about end-of-life planning from the standpoint of when you're gone. Like, you plan for your life to end. But I'm going to ask you, have you planned for your life to age? How will you live out the end of your life, the last few years, or maybe even the last 10 years or more? As homesteaders, sometimes we forget that we too will grow old, though Father Time will continuously remind us. And then I'm going to do something I've almost never done. I might have done this one other time. I'm not sure. My segment today is going to be directly related to my item of the day, which, again, is something I've just never really done. But I've been on this new regimen for self-improvement, and one of the things it requires is daily reading. And as I've taken that on, that is daily reading behind what I would have done anyway. And I finished up a book that was actually a fiction book, but by Dan Brown, called The Secret of Secrets, his latest book in the Robert Langdon series. That's not what I'm going to be talking about today. But since I was already reading that book, it's very long when I started this, I just kept doing it because Brown's books, even though they're fiction, are so based on historical facts, symbology, and things that are real and real organizations, you can't help but learn when reading. So I went ahead and finished that. And I was like, I need to get a book on, you know, business, entrepreneurship, something like that. And I thought, hey, why don't you look at stuff that's been around a while? I found a book, and I've always been aware of it, but I've never read it till now, called My Life and Work by Henry Ford. This was published in 1922. I'm going to tell you why it might be the best book on business you've never read. I'm not going to say it is, because I don't know. Maybe you did. But this will really hit the mark for entrepreneurs, would-be entrepreneurs, and people with a head for business. That's where this book, but it's also a book that I think libertarians and anarchists would love. Ford wasn't an anarchist or a libertarian even, but I think he was without knowing it. I think the word was so tainted, as bad as it is today, if you go back to, like, this book was written right after World War I, okay, that word was like Nazi today or racist. Actually, it had more meaning because it wasn't overused yet, just improperly used. But my God, this man had solutions to problems that we think is modern problems that were actually problems in the 1800s and 1900s that would work today, except there's one problem. There's one thing in the way, government regulation. It's the same as it ever was. And I think you guys would really love this book. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things I learned in it. And even though I'm going to do like a 7 to 10 minute segment on it, I can, and maybe someday will, do an entire episode on it. If I were C.J. Kilmer, I might do an episode per chapter or per two chapters. I mean, it's that deep and that good. All right, with that, let's go ahead and remind you guys that you can help support this show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Again, I'm going to talk about the item of the day for today as part of my segment. So I just want to real quick run through the other items that we have mentioned this week that are all in today's show notes. One is the Cyanatech remote control light switch kit. This thing's awesome. You plug these little remotes in. Each of them has a number. You get a little remote control. One on and off, two on and off, just buttons. You push them, the power comes on. Push off, goes off. So many things you can do with it. The Knipex Cobra pliers changed my life. J.R. Haley gave me a set of these about 2 years ago, and I won't, when it comes to the things that Knipex does right, and Cobra pliers are one of them, I won't even look at anything else anymore. I carry the smallest ones in my EDC. The biggest ones will take anything off. They're basically the channel lock you never knew existed that should have existed, and after you use these once, you'll give away or sell your channel locks. I'm telling you. Anchor V20i open-ear headphones, love those. They're still on sale for now. Make a great gift. And the Merton and Stork carbon steel skillets. All of those are in today's show notes. Check that out. With that, let's go ahead and listen to Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini.
We do have a discussion today. We want to see how the employment rates are going, because it depends on who you read and which TV station you look at. Because if you want good news on how wonderful everything is, then we know where to go. Anyway, Chris, what do you have on that?
Yeah, we're not the TV, Dr. Paul. Thank goodness for that. We try to tell the truth as best as we can. The TV has a very big agenda. They're basically the mouthpiece for the government. So with President Trump, this first year has been a very rough one. We needed government off our backs. Instead, he gave us a ton of extra weight on our backs directly by taxing us to death with increased spending, deficits, tariffs or taxes on us, the debts. All of that has been exploded higher. But even, you know, worse, or a very big part of it, it has been all empire all year long. Right out of the gate, Iran, the terrible Gaza that we financed, Ukraine war. Here we are in December, Ukraine war. It's way past day one. He still has not walked away from that. And now there's a new target, Venezuela. So it's been all empire all year, and as could be expected, when you're focused on trying to put the world under your thumb, the people at home who have to pay for it are just getting smashed, you know, and the layoffs are the highest since 2020, which was the COVID years. One headline that really bothers me was from Bloomberg, and it says that mom-and-pop business bankruptcies hit a record as debts rise. I mean, if you're going to talk about making America great again, that's what made America great again, is you could go open a business, entrepreneurship, competition, innovation. Mom and pops are going out. That's how it's been my whole life. I remember as a kid, I mean, how many there were. And it was even better when my parents were alive. There were shops everywhere. You go and you start a business to serve your community. That is still going down the drain, in all for just consolidating into big companies that are tied to the government. You know, and President Trump, speaking of 2020, since the layoffs are as big as they were then, he was president then. And that was the COVID shutdowns, which again crushed the mom and pop stores back then in 2020. Go into Walmart. There's a disease out there. Go into all the big places where you could be with thousands of people. You little guys, you go out of business.
The figures on November for unemployment, small businesses, job losses, they thought it would be around 10. So when they don't meet, when those things happen and the numbers don't come in as they had planned, it makes news. And they were a lot more than that. They were 32,000 losses in November. So it paused on. But it was all smaller people. The big guys are still doing quite well because they can live with higher prices and things, much better than the smaller companies and the individuals.
And the problem with all this is, by the time 4 years are up, Trump is rolling out the red carpet for the Democrats. I mean, this is usually what happens with Republicans. We had H.W. Bush, we had Clinton after him. And then W. Bush, no nation-building W. Bush before he was elected. Obama, you know, it adds fuel to bring these leftists in, and we could only imagine who's going to follow Trump. It'll probably be pretty bad. But the biggest betting market, Poly Market, they have Democratic Party 80% odds of them taking back the House in 2026. This is a consequence of the Republicans. They campaign like us, like libertarians, and then once the election is over, they're worse than the Democrats. And it constantly upsets people. And we don't want Democrats any more than anyone else. But, you know, the Republicans do it. They pretend that they're libertarians to get in there, and then, boy, once that voting's over, they're totally different people. It's a totally different Trump after that election than the one that was campaigning.
So a few things. One, I would give 80% odds to the Democrats taking the House this year if everything was going great. At least. Because go back all the way to the 70s. And in general, whichever party controls the White House loses the House in the first midterms if they had it. If they didn't have it, they didn't gain it, no matter how well they did. It happened to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan always had to deal with Tip O'Neill because the Republicans never had control of the House. The most popular Democrat president, I have to say, in my life, wasn't Obama. People are going to think I'm crazy for saying it. It was Bill Clinton. It happened to Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton lost the House. And the era of Newt Gingrich came in. This is a typical cycle that occurs. So I'd put the odds more like 90 to 95%, unless something drastically changes next year, that the Republicans lose the House. And again, I would say that the odds would favor the Democrats, even if everything was hunky-dory, and Orange Man wasn't doing stupid shit, like starting out the year talking about taking over Canada and Greenland, and now talking about starting a war in Venezuela. And a lot of the other dumb shit he says. Where I disagree here is, number one, I do blame Trump some for what happened during COVID, because his 2 weeks to flatten the spread, he was just dumb enough to allow himself to be talked into. But the vast majority of what was done that crushed small business during COVID had nothing to do with the federal government and everything to do with 50 governors. And specifically, the only governors that didn't completely destroy their states were DeSantis, Noem, and Abbott. All other 47, Republicans included, pretty much ruined everything in their states. And when 47 of 50 states fuck shit up, okay? And South Dakota ain't big enough to matter on a national scale. So you had two big states, not completely, and they did fuck themselves up. Abbott fucked shit up worse in Texas than DeSantis allowed to happen in Florida. DeSantis was the first mover to correcting the overcorrection. So I don't blame Trump for all the little mom-and-pop stores and restaurants and shit that went out of business when the actual restrictions were placed by the governors, just because that's how logic and reason works. Who actually did it? Trump will get maybe 20% of that blame in the governors, mayors, and such get 80. Just to be fair. What Trump's doing now, when people say it's putting small business out of business, I find that the biggest problem we have with small business right now is nobody wants to do the fucking work to build a small business. I think if you want to build a small business right now, unless it's something highly regulated, there's not a damn thing preventing you except inaction. It can be done. Do you want to do it? Do you actually want to make the sacrifice and make it happen? That's the real question here. There's a hunger to do business locally, but people want to be able to get products at a price they can afford and actually be able to get the things that they want. That's the challenge in any kind of brick-and-mortar business right now. But there's actually more opportunity for small business today than there's ever been, especially if your product or service is shippable or transportable electronically. In fact, I would say there's probably more successful small business people in America today than there was in 1980. I didn't do the work to prove it, but I dare you to prove me wrong. And per capita, total number of operational small businesses that are paying income tax, meaning they are successful enough to have a profit, per capita in 1980 versus 2025, I will bet you a shitload of money that 2025 wins that. So I think sometimes we look at negative economic situations and we're too quick to blame government instead of asking ourselves what we could be doing differently. That's not a defense of Orange Man, because I'd have said the same thing when Sleepy Joe was president or Barack Obama was president. That all the times I hear people say, well, I can't start a business because, and my first response is stop, because you won't do the fucking work. Because you won't do the fucking work necessary to get it done. Okay? That has nothing to do with Donald Trump. Now, here's my take on Trump. I think the topic they're on this week versus foreign policy, he's actually done a hell of a lot of good for the economy. You just, when you have an economy this fucked up, that, by the way, can't be fixed, only made somewhat better or lessen the damage, it takes time for that cycle to come through. And I expect the economy to look really good by the midterm elections. Actually, really good. There's so much coming next year that's going to spur the economy. That doesn't mean it's going to fix the problem. Do not misunderstand what I'm saying. I didn't say fix it. I said make it better than it is. You're going to be able to buy a vehicle next year and deduct the interest that you pay on your loan from your taxes. That will matter to people a little bit, but it'll matter to the economy a great deal, because a lot of things, you know, when you have a lot of people with a little bit of extra money, that's a lot more money moving in the economy. A lot of these investments, I'm going to tell you right now, I think that Trump's braggadocious bullshit about, you know, trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars coming into America, I think he's overshooting the number by 50%. It's double what it really is going to end up actually being. That's still a shitload of money. There's a lot of things in the economic policies going on here that are highly beneficial, but when you have something as fucked up as this is, those things take time to unwind and actually come out the other side. Now, the downside is, all this is going to do long term is drive inflation through the roof, and I would say to anybody pointing that out, and what's your alternative? Because your alternative and my alternative are probably the same, and my question is, does the American people have the stomach to go through that pain before they have no choice but to go through that pain? I think some of y'all know what I'm talking about. So I mostly agree here, but I don't think the economic situation is as bad as people claim, and I don't think the actions of the Orange Man are to blame for the places where the economy isn't good. I think that we live in a microwave society where people expect you know, instant gratification. Now, the person that insists on calling me an Orange Man apologist, in spite of the fact that I call him Orange Man more than Trump, okay, they would probably say, well, how long is it before it's Trump's economy? And I'd say about the end of next year. It's the same thing I said when Barack Obama became president. When everybody was shitting on the economy at the end of his first year, I said, but, you know, I don't think what he's this different. I don't think what he's doing is going to really help us that much. The economy is pretty resilient, and the system in play will probably drive us some level of recovery here, but it'll be a false recovery. But before you blame somebody for something, you have to give them enough time to do the things necessary to correct the problem. So it's the same standard. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead now, and we are going to hear from, who are we going to hear from? We'll hear from Matt Sersley on this new 1099 DA. Maybe it should be DOA, dead on arrival.
Hey, TSP. This is Matthew Sersley with AgoristTaxAdvice.com, here to talk about some more tax stuff happening. There is a significant change in 2025 involving digital assets, including cryptocurrency. The IRS is rolling out a new form for 2025 tax year. You'll start getting these in 2026. And it's the form 1099-DA, 1099 Digital Assets. It's designed to bring crypto into the same reporting system as stocks. But the way most people hold and use digital assets was going to make these forms very inaccurate by default. If you don't fix it, if you're not ready to fix it, you could actually be taxed on gains you never actually made. So, these forms are going to be issued by U.S. exchanges, brokers, and digital asset platforms. There's a bit of a fight for a while where wallets going to have to do this, etc., and no, they're not going to, but things like Coinbase, CoinEx, etc., are going to have to do these. They're going to have to report your gross proceeds from crypto sales. They're going to have to report your cost basis if they have it. They can report transactions from one cryptocurrency to another, and eventually those are going to be required, but don't expect much of that in 2025. And they're going to send a copy of this to the IRS, whether these numbers are right or not. So on paper, this functions very much like the 1099B that you may get from your stockbroker. It says, okay, he had this stock, he bought it for this much, he sold it for this much, here's the increase in value, here's basically the capital gain. And for people who buy on Coinbase, keep it on Coinbase, sell it on Coinbase, and especially trade all on one of these platforms, it is going to be a godsend. It's going to make your taxes a lot easier. But in practice, the crypto world doesn't work like traditional finance. And that's because crypto is portable. You know, not your keys, not your coin. So you may buy it on a platform, but you probably move it to a wallet. You may trade it on chain. You may send it to another thing. You may turn it into another currency and another currency and another currency, and then sell it years later. And so most exchanges are going to have no idea what your cost basis is unless it was on the exchange the entire time. And so what most of these reports are going to say you have a $0 basis, and whatever you traded that cryptocurrency for is going to show up as a 100% capital gain. In addition, they're not necessarily going to know whether it's a short-term or a long-term gain. Now, the IRS is going to see this form and assume you owe taxes on that whole sale amount. And unless you correct it, they get to assume it's accurate. So what happened when it's wrong? It's your job to prove it's wrong, and that is not going to be easy. So, for example, let's just take a case. Alex buys $1,000 of Bitcoin in 2017 and never touched it, except he moved it off of Coinbase, he put it on his wallet, and then in 2025, he sends it back to Coinbase, and he sells it. Well, Coinbase is probably going to – he sells it for $10,000, say. Coinbase is going to issue that 1099 reporting the proceeds of $10,000. And since they don't know the cost basis, they're going to leave it blank or report $0. Either way, the IRS is going to think he made a $10,000 profit, not a $9,000 profit. And on capital gains, that's going to be a difference of $150 to maybe $250. Even worse, if they think it's a short-term gain, now maybe they may think he owes, you know, 35-37% on that whole $10,000 instead of the probably 15 or 20% he really does. So you can see how this can get very, very, very complicated very quickly. Now, you can't actually correct the 1099-DA, but what you can is report the accurate info. It's a different tax form. It's form 8949, and this is where you report where a 1099 has the wrong cost basis on it. So you fill out this form. But you need to send in records. You know, things like maybe CSVs showing all the different transactions, your wallet transfers, your purchase confirmations. You maybe even will need to use a blockchain explorer to show which coins were yours. If you have a lot of transactions in that time, or you're dollar cost averaging, so you have a lot of different bases, definitely use some sort of crypto tax software like Coin Tracking or Coinly to rebuild your basis and track the assets across the wallets. And it's your responsibility to prove your basis. If you can't prove it, the IRS gets to assume the 1099 DA is correct, and it's either zero or unknown, in which case it's zero. So I assume in 2026, basically every 1099 DA is going to be wrong, with the exception of people who have been doing everything on exchange and never moved it off. Same thing for tax year 2026 and 2027, it's going to be bad. Now, there are rules where eventually these companies are supposed to start contacting you and get the information from you about the basis before they report it to the IRS. And that'll be easier, because then you'll just need to convince Coinbase or whatever of the numbers and not correct the wrong number in the IRS system. But this is going to be a problem. The IRS is going to send out a lot of letters to a lot of people saying you owe a lot of taxes, and they're not going to accept all of these changes in forms. So, you know, be ready for mistakes, and frankly, be ready to overpay the taxes you legally owe because you can't prove what they are. For this reason, I would be especially careful in 2025 and 2026 about selling for cash if you can avoid it. And of course, the market's down recently, so hopefully if you needed to sell it, you sold it a month ago and aren't selling it now. But if you do need to sell for cash, you know, do your best to do it something you can track easily. Make sure you can prove your basis on it so that when the IRS comes after you for those taxes, you're at least not overpaying what you owe. If you want to consult with me on this or just about any topic on saving money on your taxes, whether you're a high-earning W-2 employee or a business owner or a crypto trader, please reach out to me at agristaxadvice.com/TSP. I now give out my full Agorist Tax Toolkit. It's a number of useful tools and documents to help you save money, trackers, spreadsheets, and documents. You'll also get a link to schedule a call with me and see if we can work together long term. Thanks and have a great day.
Matt may end up being right about his conclusion about how much you're going to have to do to prove it, but historically, that's not how it's been with other changes. And I'm going to talk about two. I don't remember the form he named, but I remember when it happened where the brokerage firm started doing this. And that is more analogous. So let me cover that one first. So what he's talking about was done with brokerage accounts. It used to be that the only thing that was visible to the federal government when you sold a stock was that you sold the stock. And your brokerage didn't issue shit. You had to report it, and if you didn't, that's when you got in this problem. They'd say, well, you sold 1,000 shares of, you know, Ford Motor Company, and that made you $10,000 at $10 a share, and we're going to tax you on $10,000 as a zero basis. Which is absolutely fucking retarded, because where, pray tell, would I get Ford Motor Company stock for free? How is that possible? With crypto, it actually at least is, but that didn't make any sense. So the way that actually worked is anything prior, as far as your holdings, to the issuance of the form, you just did what you always did and declared a basis. So we'll see if that works out here. I believe the form he's talking about is to correct an inaccurate basis where the problem is an error, not a lack of knowledge. So if I've held the crypto from prior, then it's actually incumbent upon them to demonstrate that my basis is inaccurate. Now, talk to your CPA. We're going to see this is an emerging thing. Here's another instance where this same kind of shit caused problems for years, and it may imply remedy as to what you can do with a good CPA. Again, always take direction from your CPA. And it works like this. As part of the Patriot Act, for some reason, they decided we needed something called a 1099-K. And a 1099-K was something that your merchant account provider, if you sold online with Visa, MasterCard, American Express, etc., like a PayPal account or a Stripe account, that every year, if you were over the number that the government says, which is the number of transactions or total number of dollars or both, you got this 1099-K. And it really wasn't much of a problem. It's actually kind of useful because it helps you do your own internal audit. Did I account for everything? Well, the problem came up with this. Let's say that I have an advertiser and I charge them $300 a month through PayPal. And that advertiser sends me a 1099 that says, hey, we got charged this much money by this person. And I say, absolutely, and I report it in my revenue. Well, then PayPal reports it on the 1099-K, and that $3,600 is duplicated, and it just turned itself into what? $6,400. And now I'm being double taxed on the same receipt. That's what happened with 1099-Ks, and I've dealt with this. And all my accountant did was use preparer notes, which is something that exists on your tax preparation, especially when you're with like a firm, a registered CPA firm or something like that. And I'm sure it's in like, I don't ever use TurboTax or anything. It's probably in there too, to say, hey, look, this is a duplication. The revenue is accurately reported. And we've never had any problems with that. So we'll have to wait and see how much you really have to do. But what is being asked of people in this is what we would call an undue burden. There's a lot of people been holding a lot of cryptocurrency for a long time, and the ability to go back and do all the shit he just said is not possible. And generally speaking, no matter how unreasonable your government is, when there's something that's an undue burden, it ends up going to the courts, and the government has to make accommodation for it, or they have to make accommodation for it so that it doesn't go to court. And this would be a layup for someone that specializes in the space to prove an undue burden. Because how does a person actually provide you with all that data, even if they have very good records, to actually prove it conclusively to a person who can't possibly comprehend it, because the people doing this can't? I don't think it's going to be as big a problem, but it is something that you should start taking better recording of what you're doing. My bigger problem is, are some of these retarded companies going to report withdrawals, okay, as sales or as expenditures? So if I'm on Coinbase, for instance, and I say I want to take money off, I just throw an address in, and Coinbase sends me that address. Okay, how do they know it's me or Bill or Tom or Frank or Susie or Tammy? Well, the answer is they don't. It's designed that way. It's pseudonymous, right? You can kind of figure it out, but you don't really know. And so this is an example. There was about $60 worth of shit in my Strike account last year that they reported to me on a tax document as discharges. In other words, there was money that I was accountable to pay tax on. And it was such a small amount of money, I just said, fuck it. I can make that up. But if it had been, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, that would have required some more work. And so never underestimate the government's ability to fuck something up that just needs to not be touched, because there's no reason for this right now, at least not for the format in which they've done it. Let's go ahead. I mean, even if you're a statist, they could have done this much more cleanly. All right, so let's go ahead now and take a look at three hunting rifle questions from one person in one email to one expert.
What is going on, TSP? Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast to answer your gun-related questions. This question this week is coming from somebody who didn't give their name, just initials. So he's pretty sneaky, though. He snuck in three questions in the one question and in the one email. So I'm going to do my best to answer all three briefly. The first one's pretty easy, although I don't think it's what you should do. He asks about mounting an optic on an AR-15 for deer hunting, because he already has it. Now, I don't try and do this all the time, but I did an entire episode on this on my podcast, where I talk about hunting deer with an AR-15. I'm not saying it's a great idea. I'm saying if you're going to do it, there are best practices. This question about mounting an optic is fairly straightforward. You get an optic whatever you want to use. I would say a 1-4, a 2-7, a 3-9 with the appropriate mount. Now, be advised, the AR is not like traditional hunting rifles. It has a buffer tube, so it has a straight stock, which means you need a higher mount than you would normally need for something with a swept stock like most other rifles have. But many optics today, if you're new to this, which this emailer just from his email seems to be, just get one that already has the mount on it. Many of them do. So if you're at all ambiguous about what kind of mount, get one, get an optic that's already built with an AR mount on it, or it comes with an AR mount on it. That's real simple, easy, done. The next question is, should I just get something else like a 270, or I'm going to add in there 308, 30-06? Yes, you should. I don't know if this is going to be the case when you are on the internet, when you listen to this, but I just saw a thing, the daily deals, after rebate, Savage Axis, brand new on Palmetto State Armory, 308 Savage Axis bolt action and for $250. That is a better option. You can hunt deer with an AR-15, and many people do. It is a compromise. It's an intermediate cartridge. It will work, but it's not as good as a 308, which is a full-powered rifle cartridge. Or take your pick if you just don't like 308 and a real man's cartridge is 30-06. Get one in 30-06 or 270. You're arguing minutia. Those are all full-powered rifle cartridges. 5.56 is an intermediate cartridge. Now, if you are going to do it, I don't think the big thing is the optic. I think the big thing, if you're going to do it with an AR-15, is proper bullet selection, not M855, not XM193 military loads. What I'm talking about is, if you're going to do this, again, I'm not saying it's a great idea, but at least a 62 grain bonded or higher, or a solid copper monolithic projectile. And sure, you can do it. You know, you can shoot a deer in the face with a 5.56 full metal jacket and it will die. But that's not a best practice. If you are going to do it with 5.56 223, proper bullet choice is way more important than whatever optic you decide on. So I'm going to answer that with your question on, should I get something else like a 270? Yes, you should. They're cheap. They're affordable. If you can afford it, go that route if you want to hunt deer with it. Now, if you're just going to use something you already have, then by all means do that. But if you're going to get something for deer hunting, get a proper full-powered rifle cartridge if you're going to hunt deer with a rifle. Now, hang on here. I'm here to help you, but I'm going to spank you. I'm going to spank you because I care about you. The last part of your email I want to read verbatim, so I'm not putting words in your mouth. I tried iron sights my first encounter with a deer, and I was shaking so bad from adrenaline and cold shivers, I hit the front shoulder and couldn't find the sucker after hours of tracking. The blood trail stopped. I'm guessing clotting due to shot placement. Okay, here I'm going to spank you. This is not an optics problem. Do not look for a hardware solution to a software problem. If you had in fact had an optic on that rifle, it would have made the problem worse, not better. How is that possible? You said you were shaking. If you have a magnified optic, that is only going to exacerbate the shaking you see in the sight picture and probably make you more nervous, not less nervous. This is not an optics problem. This is a psychological problem. It's not one that's uncommon to man, right? People talk about buck fever all the time. But your solution is not a hardware solution. It's a software solution. This happens all the time in many different disciplines. For instance, people all the time, I'm an FBI handgun instructor. I'm state pistol champion several times over. Many, many people, especially when they're new to handguns, if they're right-handed, they drop shots low left. They drop shots low left. They drop shots low left. They are flinching. Okay, you can give them a better gun, they're still going to flinch. They can put an optic on their handgun, they're still going to drop shots low left. Why? Because it's not a hardware problem, and you're not going to fix it with hardware. With a shotgun, many times when a bird gets in front of somebody with a shotgun, they lift their head up off the stock. Okay, this you can give them a $30,000 over and under shotgun, they're still going to do that. That's not going to fix the problem. You are having a software glitch. Don't fix it with a hardware problem. Fix it with the software. Fix it with you and your mental state. And now, this is already three questions in one. I'm not going to do a whole segment on that. If you want to hear that segment, then write in. But the optic on the gun is not going to fix that problem. You, with a proper mental state of mind, is going to execute that problem. The optic was not going to fix that problem for you. So, all those other questions being said, your main problem is not that you need an optic on your gun. So stop with the very, and I love America, I fought for America, but a very American thing to do. How can I throw money and fix this problem? How can I just buy something and fix this problem? This is not a money problem. This is a you being pumped full of adrenaline, shaking when you see a deer in front of you. And the optic's not going to fix that. So I'm not saying, you know, a bolt action rifle with a proper optic is not a better hunting tool. It absolutely is, but that's not going to fix your problem. So fix the root of the problem. Okay. I'm sure Jack will probably have something to add to this. Thank you guys. Thanks TSP. Thanks Jack, and have a blessed day.
So I can completely agree. You are not going to be a better shot with an optic if your problem is mechanical. Okay. If your problem is your fundamentals are good, but you're just not that great of a shot, an optic can make you a little bit better. But if you're not that great of a shot, your fundamentals probably aren't that good. It's just kind of like a round, roundabout thing. But there's no doubt a person who is a good quality shot tends to be a better shot with an optic than without. Otherwise, well, nobody would use them. But if you suck, and it sounds, I'm going to be worse than, I guess, than he is in saying this, but it sounds like you do. And it sounds like it's not that you're a bad shot, it's that you're a bad shot at a living animal. And Mike's right. If you are having a problem with that gun, those sights moving on you, because you're amped up with your adrenaline, then when you look through a scope, let's say it's a 6-power scope, that movement you're seeing that's fucking with your head, that's making it worse than it already is, it will be 6 times greater. I've talked about this a lot over the years, but when you put magnification on anything, you put magnification on everything. It's a lot like audio. Like, people are like, just boost the audio if your expert panel member is too quiet. I do, but it's always shitty quality, and that's because all the static, all the hiss, all the pops, all the background noise gets amplified with the part you want to hear. So when you boost audio, you also boost the noise that's inside the audio. See how that works? When you magnify something, and I can think back to when I was a kid, and I got a pretty good telescope. I think that with the eyepiece I was using, it was somewhere along a 50x magnification. And I'm outside with it, and I got it set up on a picnic table, and me and my buddy are looking at the moon, which was really cool at that level of magnification. You can see the craters and everything. But we're noticing that, like, you have it dead focused in center, and then you let your buddy, he goes, it's almost out of the frame. When you look at it, it's out of frame. And the moon looks like it's in the same spot. Well, that scope, let's say, is magnifying at a 50x. It's magnifying the movement of the moon and its orbit around the Earth at 50x as well. So that is the same thing. When you look through a 12x scope, your shaky is 12 times more shaky in appearance, even though it's actually the same. And if you have a psychological feedback loop going, then the magnification of the shake will make the shake worse, which will make the magnification more, which will make the shake. See what I'm saying? It's a loop. It's a hell loop. How do you break it? You practice sufficiently until you are so confident in your base level ability, not arrogant, but confident in your base level ability, the deer comes and you wall off the fact that it's a deer and you make it a shot and you take the shot, and then you can have all of the heartbeat and shit you want. Okay? That's how you do it. It is self-doubt creeping in that causes this. So developing confidence, and this happens to people all the time. Don't feel bad about it. What happens is people go out and shoot once or twice, you know, a year. Maybe about a week before season, they go out and shoot. They shoot all off a bench. And especially if you're in the South, you're thinking, well, I'm going to be in a blind. I'm going to have a rest. I'll be fine. It'll be the same. No, it won't. There's a big difference in having a 2-point anchor on a bench and a 1-point anchor going out of a blind. Both are better from a stability standpoint than offhand, but it ain't the same. I would tell you, you should probably go out and practice, and you should get yourself some like cardboard deer target cutouts and practice shooting a target that looks like a deer. That would help as well. Maybe someday we'll do a whole show on just how to dial in the mental state so that this doesn't become a problem. But again, for most people, the problem is they can shoot off a bench rest at a stationary circular target, and they do not practice enough, and they do not develop enough muscle memory. He's talking about looking over the barrel with birds. Yeah, that happens all the time, too. And another thing happens like this. It's a really nice deer. People say, oh, I'm gonna. They're already thinking about showing it to their buddy. And at the moment you're squeezing that trigger, the only thing that matters is you, that projectile, and the place it's supposed to hit. And you have to get your mind there. And optics, gear, nothing will do that other than yourself. Otherwise, there's no sport in it. There's no point to it. There's no excellence. There's nothing to master. If it can be done with gear, it's gear mastery. It's not your mastery. And hunting and taking a life, that's personal mastery. All right, let's go ahead and hear from Andy McCann on setting agendas for moving into 2026.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. My shtick here for you guys is health and fitness. But if you want more of me, because who doesn't want more of this, right? Wink, wink. I do a podcast called Fitness, Food, Finance, right? So fitness, food, and finance. I want to help you lay a firm foundation in those three things. So the question came up, Andy, 2026 is coming. The new year is coming. What should I do? Guys, I would just say start and do anything, but I made this for you last time from the fall workshop. This is a thing you can do. The question comes up. I'm getting emails right now from you and from my members and from my friends. Andy, help me out. How do I help somebody else? How do I help myself? Go to my website, crossfitgarage.com. Go to, where is it? I think it's if you go to the About. So if you're on that, yeah, go to Gym Information. At the very bottom, it says Free Resources. So, or type in crossfitgarage.com/free. It's all the free stuff that I talk about, all the things that I say you should do, I give it to you for free. You can find it here. The thing that I want you to try is 60 Easy. So it's on the left column, maybe three down. When you click it, it's going to give you 60 easy things you can do. I know you're like, wait a minute, what about 75 hard? I love 75 hard. I would force everybody to do it, except I don't want anybody to do it. I know you're like, Andy, that doesn't make any sense. I love that stuff. I would do it and I'd tell everybody to do it. I just know that it's not for everybody. 75 hard says if you mess up even one day, even one moment, you have to restart the whole thing. That's like horrible. I want you to have easy wins. So Ken Daniel went down this road. He did all of them, right? And he said, dude, it really works. He did it the harder way. I'm going to give you the easy way. So 60 easy. It's five things, one thing that you can do of the five, how you eat, sleep, think, move, and connect. So the five pillars of health and fitness, it's one of those each month for 12 months. 5 times 12 is 60. So for example, January, how you There's a list of 12 things. You just pick one of them. For eat, start eating around the edges of the grocery store, the fresh produce, meat, and dairy. So basically eliminate processed foods, right? It's an easy step. I can do that. Try shopping the edges of the store. For January, for sleep, it's avoid screen times at least 30 minutes before bed to improve your sleep quality. Yes, I can do that. That is not hard. Print this off and check it. Read it. Do it, right? For move for January, take a 10-minute walk after dinner each night. So there's a lot of things to be said about walking after you eat. So if you're not doing anything, try this. Or if you're doing a lot of stuff, add this in it. It doesn't hurt to add more steps and take a walk. Maybe put a dog on the leash or hold your spouse's hand, right? So think January. Do one act of kindness for someone each week. This is the idea of, is the world hostile or is it friendly? You need to move to the idea that the world is friendly. Do something kind. An easy one for me is when I'm at the grocery store and somebody's putting up their groceries with their cart right there at the car, I take their cart back. Now, don't be creepy like me and stand there and be like, I'm just waiting for your cart, and they don't know that. Use your words, you introverted fools, and say, hey, I'm on my way back into the store. Do you want me to take your cart for you? It works out so much better if you tell them what you're doing rather than stand there as a creeper, right? Ask me how I know. All right, so connect in January. Practice active listening in conversations without interrupting. Dude, this is tough. Don't just be preparing the thing you want to say. Actually listen and then ask questions. For me, I'm trying really hard not to solve problems. So a lot of my conversations sound like, especially with my teenage daughter, sounds like, dang, Evie, sounds like that bitch is crazy. Or, dang, Evie, I think that girl's just jealous of you. And I just say variations of that. And she's like, thank you for listening and letting me speak. I'm like, you're welcome. And we don't solve anything, but we have a great relationship now. So it's like, what are you trying to solve? So in January, what would I do? 60 easy. Now, here's the other thing. If you have a problem that money can solve, then spend the money to solve the problem. I would find yourself a gym. You know me, I like CrossFit. It's the biggest hack in health, in the way of health and fitness that I ever found. I would pay them to help you do the things you need to do. I'd also find a gym that has nutrition, and I would pay them to do that nutrition. If you're not going to use your money and the expertise that are out there, hire a mentor or a coach, then I would do the easy thing, 60 easy, and then track your food for as long as you can. I would do 2 weeks at a minimum, but longer would be better. I'll give Jack this link to 60 easy. Actually, I'll tell you what. I'll give him the link to the free resources that basically I make for you guys, and you can find 60 easy there. There's other stuff too. There's workouts and there's things. Also, Bruce Sofchi started in the Telegram a CrossFit or a workout tracker for people who've been to the workshop and all that. So if you want to get into that, talk to Bruce. He'll get you into the Telegram channel, and we talk about the workouts we did. So right now we're basically following my gym posts the workouts online, and then we also convert it to a home-based workout. So if you go to gym information and then click on WOD, you'll see that WOD is just workout of the day, and it gives the workout we're doing with an at-home version, and so you can do that, and that's what Bruce and some people are doing. So you can follow along with us. Dude, I am here to help. I want nothing from you. I just want you to live so that when we go back to the fall workshop, we see each other again, right? Sovereignty over your own health is huge. Without that, I mean, they're going to capture you with drugs and wheelchairs and walkers and stuff. So don't let them have that. Guys, hey, this is Andy McCann. You can hear more from me on fitness, food, and finance, or follow me on YouTube at AndyMcCann42. Y'all take care.
You know, the only thing I wanted to add to this one is something J.R. Haley said to me when we were talking. I don't think it was J.R. and my buddy David and I just went down the coast for the weekend, but I don't think it was on this trip. I think it was during pre-gaming, getting ready for the workshop, that J.R. and I had a conversation about hard, 75 hard. 75 hard is not about fitness in of itself. The fitness is a byproduct. 75 hard is actually a mental discipline challenge. And I think that is why the originator to it put in, if you fail, you have to start at zero. I'm with Andy. I think that actually might turn a lot of people off, but maybe those people aren't ready for it yet. Maybe something like 60 easy would be the way for them to go. The program you'll do and follow is better than the program that is better, but you won't do it or follow it or stick with it. I'll often hear people that want to argue with me about how meat is bad, carnivore's bad, keto's bad, and they'll just ignore all the positive results. And they'll say, well, if you compare the average vegan to the average American, the average vegan is healthier. And a lot of people will try to counter that with the giant, fat, pasty-looking chick that lives on donuts and calls herself vegan. I don't do that. I mean, a person that's actually a vegan for health reasons, that's thinking about what they're eating, of course they're in better shape than the average American. The average American is in the end of the line at the Texas State Fair and on 7 drugs, including metformin and insulin. Anybody who actually follows a program that is designed to make you better to the letter will be better than average, even if it's not the best program. So comparing the person following an eating program as vegan or vegetarian to the person who's eating ding-dongs and ho-hos and shoving Taco Bell in their beak, that's disingenuous, right? And so I get that there might be better levels of program, but the one you're willing to start on and do, and you might find if you get through a 60 easy, you'll be like, well, fuck that, now I'm ready for a 75 hard. Let's make this one more comparison, and we're going to go on and hear about wind energy from Ryan Steva. What if you'd never really run much, and even if you ran in your past, like you have not jogged voluntarily, other than maybe to get to your car when it's raining, for 15 years. Many of you are going, that's me. Okay, right. Like I had a friend who used to say, I only run when chased, right? That's you. and you decide, hey, I want to look into running. And you start researching, and you only find new runner programs to start with day one, run 10 miles. Or day one, run a marathon, 26 miles or whatever, 26.3 or whatever the fuck it is, right? You'd probably just say, well, fuck that. I'm not a runner. But if you found a program that said day one, run a quarter mile, jog a quarter mile, time yourself. And then do that consistently for a few weeks until your time is more, it improves by at least X percent. And now run a half mile. And then do that for a certain amount. And then run a mile. And then do that for a certain, and then run 2 miles. Then you might do that, and you might reach a point where you say, that's enough running for me, and you might then make it a regular part of your day. But if we go straight from 0 to 100, and you're very far from the ability to do 100, either in the real world or mentally, emotionally, spiritually, then you're not going to do it. So my problem with 75 hard isn't that it's hard, because it fucking says it's hard. It's how many people look at it and say, well, not that, and then therefore they're going to do nothing. And that's why I love Andy created something that was intermediate. It is enough to challenge you, but not enough that if you actually want to do better, that it should scare you. I actually think the one good thing about 75 hard is it's very, very flexible. Like, you follow a diet, but it doesn't tell you which one. You exercise twice a day, but it doesn't tell you what exercise to do. It could be a walk. It could be push-ups. It could be hitting a heavy bag. It could be running. It could be calisthenics. It could be weighted hiking, like pseudo road marching or whatever. Like, it's up to you. But it is very regimented, as these are the things you have to do, and this is how long you have to do them, and if you fail, you go back to zero. I also want to tell you this about 75 hard. What they say is, well, if you fail, you have to go back to zero. You miss one day of working out or something. I don't know, you were sick that day, so you just thought running today will make me puke, so you didn't do it. You have to start over. Who the fuck says? Who the fuck says? If you want to do 75 hard, and that is the one thing holding you back, then what you do is you do it anyway. You do it with the intent of not failing, but if you fail, the next day you get up. Maybe you give yourself 3 strikes. Right? You do it however the fuck you want to. Nobody's in charge of you but you. That's just my little motivation on that one there, because I do think it's about mental discipline. And that's why, because it is and it's designed that way, that's why people actually follow that rule. But you might be surprised. If you just simply make a commitment that when I'm deciding it versus the world made it happen, I'm going to just say to myself, self, if you give in, you're failing yourself. You might find that even with the 3-strike rule, you'll come through hitting the ball out of the park on the first pitch. All right, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Ryan Steva on Small Scale Wind.
Hey, TSP crew, this is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I've got a follow-up question on a previous segment that I did on episode 3748, where I mentioned a really simple all-in-one solar panel with charge controller, basically for battery maintaining and trickle charging. So the question on that topic is it possible to add a wind turbine to the eco-worthy 12-volt solar kit you talked about? And the details are, I want to use this to power an electric fence to keep pigs out and also to power motion-sensitive floodlights. A neighbor ranch started with a 12-volt setup, but the winter months limited the sun. Sometimes the battery discharged too much. He had an electric fence, floodlights, and a U-Wave internet dish system connected to it. He added a wind turbine, which solved the problem. This seemed like a great combo for him. All right, kind of a lot to unpack there, and I don't have as many details as I would need to give a really specific answer, but I kind of like that because I need to be a bit more general, which may be more helpful for people who are listening. First of all, the primary question was, is it possible to add a wind turbine to that system? And the technical answer is no, but you could add a wind turbine that connects to the same battery. So it would be disconnected from the eco-worthy 12-volt solar charge kit, but it would be tying into the same 12-volt battery. the wind turbine would need its own charge controller. Generally speaking, on a simple system like this, I think you could get away with it without it causing any issues. But sometimes the charge controllers can fight, especially as you get close to that maximum charge voltage. So yes, I think most likely in most cases you would be able to hook up the wind turbine to the same battery as the solar panel. However, in this circumstance, the solar panel that we're talking about is probably not an appropriate fit. And the reason is that your floodlights are likely going to take enough power that you're going to want to do the wattage calculations of your floodlights and your fence charger and build a system around it. It could still be a fairly small system, but as I said earlier, the EcoWorthy 12-volt solar kit is really more of a charge maintainer and a trickle charger. So if you're taking your batteries down overnight to a decent depth of discharge, you really aren't going to want to try to charge them back up with a small 25-ish watt solar panel and not very efficient charge controller. It's just not going to be an appropriate way to try to recharge those batteries all the way. So keep in mind that with your system, you're just going to have to do the wattage calculations, make sure that you have enough headroom and a large enough panel to fully recharge the battery each day, or a large enough wind turbine to do the same. So here's some kind of generic thoughts on wind power, because I've never talked about it on the show, and I don't think Sean Mills really talked about it, at least for quite a while, that I remember hearing. So I'm going to give kind of a really high level understanding of what wind power is and when it could or could not be beneficial. So in this segment, I'm actually going to send a link to Jack for a map of the United States that has average wind speeds at 10 meters high. And the reason I'm picking 10 meters high is that in the vast majority of cases, you're not going to want to have a wind turbine that's less than about 30 feet off the ground and 30 feet above any surrounding trees, buildings, things like that, because you want a nice consistent wind. If it's closer to the ground, you're going to get a lot less wind, and the direction that it's coming from is going to be less consistent because you're going to get cavitation from it hitting the ground. So generally speaking, with wind power and wind turbines, you want to have them at least 30 feet off the ground to get more consistent wind and power generation. With that extra height means there's extra hardware. So you've got a pole, you've got down guys, you've probably got to put in some type of footers to tie those things to. So you've got a lot of extra cost there, but also consider that since wind turbines are a lot less used in the United States, especially at least on the personal level or consumer level, that you're paying a lot more per watt for the wind turbine than you are for solar panels. And when you add in the fact that you have to put in this large hardware infrastructure, it becomes even less appealing. But wind does have one major benefit, and that's that wind can still blow at night, especially if you have the turbine high enough. And so you can be charging both day and night. So what you give up in overall wattage, you benefit in that you can charge at a time when your solar panels can't charge. So really, that's the major benefit to wind that I can think of. I hope that gives people kind of a general idea. If you want to see if wind is viable in your area, go ahead and look at that link I sent to Jack, and that should give you at least a place to start. And if anybody in the audience needs help figuring out whether or not a wind turbine makes sense for their given circumstance in doing the calculations, feel free to reach out to me. That's the kind of thing I do. So I hope that helps. If anybody has any more questions, feel free to send those into Jack. I'd love to get them answered. If you guys could all do me a huge favor, if you are interested or like the segments that I do, I think you would love my YouTube channel. And I have all kinds of great DIY how-to, both with solar preparedness and all kinds of homesteading type topics. So if you just search The Homestead Consultant on YouTube, you'll find my channel, and I would love to have you there to carry on conversations and to really just build this community in understanding how to do all kinds of different really helpful, useful things. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening. And until next time, go get your hands dirty.
Good stuff there. I'm going to say something about wind power in general on a small scale. I think a lot of the negative views of it are because the expectations that people had as these technologies became more and more available were so above what was possible, and well, people will say it's not worth it or whatever. But do the math. How much comes out of it versus how much does it cost versus how much does that power cost? Or if you're in a place where there is no power, then that changes the calculus as well. I think small-scale wind is an incredibly valid technology. It's just also a limited technology with limited effect. And when you start having to put up big towers and stuff, then the cost ain't so good. Just saying. All right, so let's move on and hear from Nicole Sauce about removing roadblocks and some stuff on end-of-life planning.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Hollow Roast Coffee to talk to you about something that came to mind after hearing Jack talking about how to spend your downtime when you get into the winter. And he suggested decluttering your life. And it got me to thinking about a process that happens for homesteaders. And it's that we clear an area and then something comes ripe or harvestable or it's time to cure the meat or whatever, and it takes over a space again physically. But this is a bigger thing than physical. And this is a lesson I have worked hard on for many years. And I will say that I'm coming to you as somebody who has not mastered the declutter cycle, but have put a renewed focus on that in this year as I looked at what brings value to my life. And by value, I don't just mean monetary value, but also the spiritual value. And the big thing is mental clutter. So a lot of times we'll get into a situation where we're building roadblocks for ourselves through not working through the things we should or not dealing with the clutter that we should in our lives. And then those start feeding each other and you end up in this cycle of the physical clutter is in the way and it's causing the mental clutter, which is then making it so you won't deal with the physical clutter. And it's much the same as if you're having emotional problems or depression and then also not working with your nutrition and your body, how those things feed off each other. And all of that can lead you into a big old fun spiral. So, at this time of year, when it starts ramping up busy, it's very easy to just put things to the side and put them off till later, but that's how you build roadblocks. You end up with things like Laundry Mountain or Paperwork Monster. Those are my two biggest challenges in the household. But also, you can end up with a backlog of financial reporting and get your taxes filed late. Ask me how I know. Or you could end up with a situation where you are not prepared for what life throws at you in the form of a large illness or job loss. Well, how does that happen, you wonder? Well, here's my question. How old are you? How old are you? We just lost a community member, it apparently very suddenly, who was in his 40s. And now his wife and family are left figuring out what to do, right? Well, I don't know all the details of their situation, but I know this. It's a really good time when that happens to somebody to ask yourself, if I were to kick off tomorrow, what would happen with my family? Am I ready? Have I documented where all the money is? Have I documented what I want to happen when I pass? Have I made it so that somebody else can access my cryptocurrency or has passwords to things? Is there any estate planning in place for clarity there to make it easy once I've passed away? Have I articulated my wishes about what to do with my remains? This is something that comes up from time to time in our network. And as I thought about decluttering and I thought about this person who had lost his life that we've been raising money for, his wife, I thought, you know, as we go into the winter time, like right now, go out, have a good time, celebrate with your family, all of the things that we do in December. And if, like me, you schedule work time off, it's A, a good way to get ready for next year, but B, if you haven't put together your documentation, make yourself a promise. Give yourself a gift this year. Document what bank accounts you have and what the numbers of those bank accounts are. And even if you're feeling jiggy, put what your balance is on that. Stocks, cryptocurrency, any of your assets. Document money that you owe, credit cards, mortgages, car payments, all of those things. And any retirement accounts that you might have or policies associated with credit cards or bank accounts that come up. I think like AAA has one you automatically get, stuff like that. And then you write the if I die document. And if I die is, these are the numbers to call to get copies of my death certificate, and this is how many copies you need. This is the funeral home you could maybe work with. These are the people who need to know, and they'll take it from there. If you have something complicated like cryptocurrency that your spouse may not know how to use, have somebody dedicated to helping them get that. That's something that I've seen repeatedly happen in our network, where one person dies and the spouse doesn't know what anything about Bitcoin, but they have like $100,000 in Bitcoin, which would be really nice to use, right? So those sorts of things. And then once you have that, it's time to talk to a lawyer about your estate planning and get it set up so the transition is as easy as possible. I know, having recently lost somebody, that because of the size of their estate and the what they wanted, they had set up a trust a couple years before they died, and that made the transition really easy because it just went from one trustee to another, and so we were able to support that person, and we didn't have to go through probate or anything else crazy. What can happen if you don't put that in place is you've just cursed your family to a year of having to go through all sorts of, well, challenges to get access to what you wanted to go to them anyway. And it can be hard to have this discussion because we don't want to admit that we are mortal. It's not fun to think about, what if I die? What if I and my spouse die? What if my children die first and they can't inherit? You know, like all the, you're going to go through all those questions. But once you have your documentation, which you can do in a week between Christmas and New Year, if you're taking that week off, it's easier to have those discussions and make those decisions and get a will or a trust or any, whatever you need to have in place, appropriate for your state, because different states have different regulations on that. And then that's one thing that often goes wrong for people that you've planned for. And it's a roadblock you haven't put in front of yourself, because you may not know it, but a piece of you is probably worrying every time you have a physical challenge or you hear about somebody passing away. Oh yeah, I need to do that thing. And then from there, if you're feeling like you want to go into advanced mode, you can also put together your plans for if you do need to bug out, and that kind of documentation. You can put things on encrypted thumb drives and put them in other people's safes. That's a really good idea, because then if you have a fire, you don't lose all your documentation all the way. So that's kind of what I was thinking about. And then examine the other roadblocks you've built for yourself, whether it's a frame of a doorway you never put the trim on and painted that you look at every time you walk into your house and it drives you nuts and you think about it and you spend valuable mental capacity there, or putting your gardens to bed for the year, or getting a list of everything you do and looking at that list and saying, okay, three things are coming off that list this year. Three things on this list are definitely not where I should be spending my focus, and I can put more focus in the other things if I get rid of three things. If you do that, you're going to be way ahead of many other people. Anyway, those are my thoughts in response to Jack's segment. If you want to support me, it is Christmas coffee gift buying season at hollowroast.com, and we've got a bunch of gift ideas on the homepage. We are in a month of perks, so each week there's a different freebie that you can get if you buy coffee. And this week it is a free chocolate-covered espresso bites, which everybody loves those dark chocolate espresso bites. and they go into any order over $30. If you want to gift copy to somebody, like a sampler pack or something, and it's over $30, they will get the free espresso bites as a cute little bonus in their gift. Of course, we've got gift wrapping. I handwrite all the cards with your custom message. That's all over at hollowroast.com, and that perk is good through midnight Sunday. I think it's December 7th. And then a new one launches for the next week, and we have one every week through the month of December. Don't forget to get your Jack's Bourbon cooled. We've got about 40 pounds of that left. I was unable to resupply the coffee this year, so it is what it is until next season's harvests. With that, go out and make it a great week.
So the only thing I want to add to the end of life thing is end of life, when we use it from an estate planning concept, generally we're talking about we dead and everything happens after that. And that's an important conversation. I'm not saying it isn't, and you should listen to what Nicole had to say. But there's end of life cycle, maybe is a better way to put it. And what I mean by that is 80, lots of people are living past 80, but it's a pretty good number to say that a lot of people don't either. So if you go with 80 is kind of like where you have a high probability ending up in the ground, and you, again, you may make 90, but you may not, then we would look at the decades, you know, 1 to 10, 11 to 20, 21 to 30, right, and say each of those represents 1/8 of a human life. And that, and if you ain't 50 yet, you're not going to really understand what I'm going to say. But after 40, guys, your extended warranty is out and no one will renew it for you. And your car is going to start having problems and need repairs. Huh? And so there's kind of a downhill. But 40 to 50 ain't so bad. And 50 to 60 so far ain't so bad. Apparently, they say 45 and 66 hit guys like a truck. We'll see. 45 wasn't that bad. It's probably because my health was dog shit, and it's right about the time I decided to recover it. So maybe since it got better, I didn't see how the other side of it went down. But that would mean that when you hit 60, you only have 2/8, right? Which is, what, 1/4? You've been through 3/4 of your life. You're in the final quarter. No one wants to think that way. Just like she said, no one wants to think about, like, but what if you die? But what if your kid dies before you? What if your kid and you die together? No one wants, but you have to. Right? So you don't want to think about this being like your final quarter, but it's your final quarter. And sometimes the game ends early. Sometimes even if the game's still going on, the fans get up and walk out. And what that means is in that final quarter, your ability to do things declines. No matter, and we should all work to stay as active and healthy for as long as we can, in spite of how much maybe we've done to harm ourselves along the way and dug a hole, we should try to dig out of as much. But there's the person that works out 5 days a week, eats right, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't do anything negative, still will go through this decline. Maybe later than they would have otherwise, but they'll still go through it. So part of end of life planning to me is, what does that final quarter look like? How do I set my life up? Not just because everybody focuses on retirement. How much money am I going to have? What's my cash flow going to be? Can I afford to live as long as I'm going to live? And then then the only thing we usually talk about in this realm is, what if I need long-term care? So long-term care insurance and things like that may come into the discussion. What about, am I going to be able to walk up that hill and go up there to the top of that hill on my homestead and do the things on the top of that hill when I'm 70? And if the answer is maybe not, like I'm going to try, but maybe not, maybe now is the time to create some way to get up there that's not going to be as hard, which will be good for efficiency anyway. And just all I'm saying is make that part of your end of life planning, is plan for your end of life cycle as well. Like, how am I going to be continue to be able to do the things that give me pleasure in life for as long as possible? Not just have somebody come in and do it for me. That's a solution. But most of the things that we do, I find we don't do them because we have to, especially once we're in retirement age. We do them because we want to. And when I have to have somebody do something for me that I would like to do, well, that's not so great. So just keep that as part of your plan. All right. So now let's talk about this new book that I've been reading. And I'm like, I want to say I have about an hour left, and I think it's like a 13-hour audio. So I'm 1/14th away from finished, right? It's called My Life and Work by Henry Ford. And as I said in my intro, it might be the best book you've never read. Might be, because I don't know what you've read, right? And maybe you did read something better than it. I don't know. Or maybe there's a book you haven't read that will be better. I'm not sure. But I think for a lot of you guys that read business books, motivational books, books on leadership, because it was published in 22, you know, if you're my age or younger, you might have just thought, I don't need something from 1922. I know what Ford did. He made the Model T in the assembly line and maybe did some other good shit. No, you don't know. You don't know. What I want to lead off with is some of the things we think we know that we don't know. So I'm going to tell you that Brad on Facebook, I know Brad really well. He's been around the community a long time. He's a good dude. I'm not putting him down at all. And he's paraphrasing here because he's just off the cuff making a comment on Facebook. But I made a post about Henry Ford, and it's not even really about Ford. It's serendipitously about a post I made before it. And this guy Nathan said, when I was a kid, I had a biography of Henry Ford. I don't remember the title of the book. Could be the same book. So I must have mentioned it in the post. I know he was an old copy, read it countless times. He believed in a bunch of different things, right? And Brad says he also believed in sound monetary policy when he learned of the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. Has nothing to do with it, by the way. He said if the American people realized what just happened, there would be a revolution by morning. The quote generally given and attributed to Ford is if the people of this country understood the monetary system, there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning. This was actually said in the 1930s by a member of the United States Congress who was also paraphrasing Ford, but I'm going to suggest that he didn't do a very good job of actually catching the essence of what Ford was saying because he was more worried about his own agenda, which was the Federal Reserve sucks, which I agree with, by the way, but it's not what Ford said. So part of how I ended up reading this book is I actually wanted to quote that in my new book, and I knew it was misattributed, but I didn't know what the genesis of it was. So when I went down that rabbit hole, I found the actual quote, and it is this. It is the innate conservation of the people that kept our money good in spite of fantastic tricks which financiers play and which they cover up with high technical terms. The people are on the side of sound money. They are so unalterably on the side of sound money that it is a serious question how they would regard the system under which they live if they once knew what the initiate can do with it. Remember that this was at a time when the gold standard was still in place. This is what people don't know, though. The banking system was fractional reserve, and the gold reserve was fractional reserve against the bank's reserves. See how that works? So this had nothing to do with the Federal Reserve Act in of itself. Ford actually didn't like the gold standard. I'm sure he thought there were bigger problems based on reading this book, but he was not, like, you just think Henry Ford was all about the gold standard. Well, the gold standard was right there in place when he said what he said. So it has to be more than just that. But that's not what really sold me on this book. First of all, the life arc of this man is amazing. He grew up, you know, basically would have been considered like a lower middle class kid at the time. He wasn't poor. His dad was a farmer. They owned a farm in Michigan. But he grew up with this obsession for machines. And the first mobile machines he saw were tractors. And at the time, the only people who could really afford machinery like this, you know, other than like the railroad and stuff, was farmers. Because they had a business that they could put the equipment into. Just like today, businesses can buy things that individuals tend to be able to not afford, right? Because they can absorb them in the operational cost of the business. And so he sees this tractor, or this actually a machine one day that runs on a steam engine. It's not even a tractor. And he had always seen these things on like a trailer, and a horse actually moved them along, and then they would go do things like baling and threshing and stuff like that. So he sees this one, and there's a dude on it with like a tiller throttle, like a boat, running a steam engine, but they've run the mechanical rotator from the machine to the axle of the trailer, and it's under its own power. He's fascinated by this. The guy becomes not just a mechanic. And a mechanic in the day, you're talking about like a mechanical engineer from a technical skill standpoint, working for railroads and other concerns. He also becomes an expert watchmaker. And this is how he develops this technical skill set. He ends up going to work for Edison. And Edison actually makes him the superintendent of one of his companies. And when he figures out what he's doing, fucking around with cars, he's basically like, if you make it run on electricity, I'll throw in with you. Otherwise, you need to knock this shit off and focus on your job. So he quits. And that was when he began the foundation of Ford Motors. And he built multiple cars kind of in a garage before he put them into a production. But his entire philosophy was every year, if we do our job right, we should be making the same car only better, and it should sell for less money. It should cost less, and we should be able to pay the workers better. And that's exactly what he did. And with the exception of some years where things were effed up because of World War I, he was able to do it consistently. And every time he lowered the price, the company made more money. The minimum wage that they assigned to workers themselves went up, and the bonuses paid out to workers went up. And he believed that your workers were partners, and if you didn't see it that way, you had no business running a company. When it comes to money, his hatred of the banks and the Federal Reserve was more about intent than a gold standard. He hated that banks and financiers thought of industry and factories and plants as ways to make money. He felt they were ways to make things. And that if you made things and you got really efficient at it, really good at it, you made them as best quality as you can, and you paid people well, money would take care of itself. In those early days, they financed 100% of the company operations off company revenue. The only time they ever ended up in any debt was, again, due to the war. And a lot of people don't realize this because people know it happened in World War II. In World War I, a lot of U.S. industry was pressed into war service. In other words, you're not making cars now, Henry. You're making these things, including making the first 5,000 Fords and tractors for the government of the United Kingdom, meaning the Fords and tractor became a thing in England before it did in the United States, because it just happened to coincide with the people of the UK needing the tractors because of a food shortage due to World War I and Germany blockading shipping into their country and making supply chains harder to run. But there's a lot of other shit. His philosophy is to the best way to lift up society was that society should focus on doing three things well, and then you can employ almost everyone. And that was you need to be able to grow things, make things, and move things. If you could do those three things, society could handle any sort of chaotic social change. It didn't matter. They'd be able to handle it if you did those things. And if you did them right, you would literally be able to have full employment. When you read this book, you find out they had blind people working. They had dudes with no hands working for Ford Motor Company. There were dudes that did their job while they were convalescing in the hospital, did a lesser job. They didn't have to. They said, hey, if you want your paycheck to keep going, we can bring work to you. And they actually did it better and faster and more efficient than people were doing in the plants. He built a school that was exactly like what many in our community think schools should be like today. The school made his factory in Michigan into a classroom. Children did 1 week in a classroom and then 2 weeks working while they were still learning. The factory became the classroom. Math was figuring out how to set up a machine or how to design a tool. You know, real world math, instead of somehow one clown's going, you know, at 2 miles an hour and another clown's going at 4 miles an hour and who's going to get to the middle first or whatever, right? They came out with great general education, these kids, so they could go on to college. They had just as good an education, if not well, actually better, than what we think of as K-12 education of the time. But they were also taught work discipline. And even if they didn't want to go to work for Ford, this made them very more like people would hire these young men. You know, 18-year-old kid coming out of the Ford school. I mean, geez, they're going to show up on time. They're going to do their job. They're going to take direction. Well, like, or they wouldn't have made it through. And they had that work discipline, and it made them marketable in many trades. They were also skilled craftsmen. And they were skilled craftsmen in the exact crafts that not only gave them jobs working for Ford if they wanted it, but unlike the guy off the street, they wouldn't start at the bottom. They could go right into like tool making or something that actually made them a higher level of income. They were paid to go to school. About one third of the money that was paid to an adult doing the same job. But they were only paid when they were doing the work side, not when they were in the classroom. Okay? And they were forced to save a portion of their earnings, and the rest was theirs to do with as they pleased, which at the time it was very common for young kids to drop out of school to help the family. So they could help the family while they went to school without going backwards. And at the same time, they were building a nest egg to launch their life with, or what I call a life establishment fund. All right? The school made no profit. It was not designed to be profitable, but it was designed to pay for itself. And the work the kids did had sufficient value that even with having to throw a lot of stuff away or recycle it, the stuff that came out of it that met quality was enough value in it to go into production to pay for the school. So the school was a zero cost. Ford also built a hospital. He ended up owning it because he donated money when they said, we're going to build a hospital here in Michigan. Okay, I'll throw down some money. I got money. I like money, right? But I'll give you some money. Well, the people behind the project, some bitch, when you're using somebody else's money that's not loaning you, it's given to you as a form of charity, they were inept. They didn't know what they were doing. And they got about halfway into the project, and they're out of money. So they go back to the donors and they ask for more money. And Henry basically tells them, get bent. You were so stupid that you didn't know the cost of the project before you started it. You told us all you could do with the money we gave you. We gave you the money. Now you can't do it. I don't have any confidence that if we give you more money, one, it'll get done. But two, even if it does, you're not going to run it well. You couldn't even build it. How are you going to run something you can't build? So he ends up buying out the project, invests $9 million into it, which that's a lot of fucking money in the 19-teens. The hospital was one of the best run and most affordable hospitals at the time. It wasn't just well run from a standpoint of operations. It was well run from a standpoint of healing and health and patient satisfaction. Everybody was treated the same. There's no private rooms or special rooms. Any doctor working there had to work only there and have no outside practice. And a patient was treated there for their problem. They had a way to allocate doctors and nurses per patient, including every patient received multiple examinations, diagnosis, and prescription, including surgery, from multiple doctors. All of those were independent. They never looked at each other's conclusions. And all, like, let's say I had five, you know, they had five diagnostics on me. They would all go to the head of the hospital, the top doctor. He'd look at all five of those, come examine me if he needed to himself, and then decide who was right. Because Henry thought that doctors were more concerned with defending their diagnosis than healing their patient. Tell me he was wrong. That's just scratching the freaking surface. So, yes, this is about somewhat his biography and his story. And, yes, cars and building cars in factories and how the factories run. But it's the other 80% that's the most valuable. And even the 20% that's really directly dedicated to, like, how they built a car or something, the lessons in efficiency, mindset, business management, this is the best book on business I have ever read, full stop. Let me add one more thing. On the audio and on some of the crying and whining in the Amazon reviews, if you throw out a few social justice warriors who hate capitalists that had to show up and say something, probably never read the book, the only real criticism of this book is the people that don't like the writing style and the way the words are put together and the way it reads and whatever. It reads like it was written in the 1920s because that's when it was written. It's written in the language and the cadence and the speaking and the terminology that a sophisticated person would use in 1920. Son of a bitch, people in 1920 talked like people in 1920 and wrote like people in 1920. This actually brings me to the part that I love about the audio. And I mean, I love this about the audio. The gentleman that reads the book is named, oh God, let me find his name real quick here. Traber Burns. And to kind of drive home the point of who this dude is, he actually looked up like other books he's narrated, like Louis L'Amour books and stuff like that. It's the kind of thing. And some other stuff, some more modern stuff, but a lot of Louis L'Amour books he's also narrated. He sounds like what you'd expect somebody to sound like in 1922 when the book was published. He keeps it in character. I don't know. I didn't listen to anything else he did. So I have no idea if that's his voice or if he's embellishing a little bit. But if you think to like, if you're my age, when you used to watch like old black and white films in school about how not to cut your hand off with a bandsaw or something, and all the kids in it had crew cuts, they were probably made in the 1950s. The narrator on that, he kind of sounds like that, but not so monotonously annoying. But he has that, you know, or if you've watched old World War II training films, he sounds like that, which is perfectly fitting for the vernacular, the voice, the tone that comes through in the writing. One more thing, because this is not even related to the book directly. I just learned about something. I heard about this a couple times, never looked into it. And I noticed it when I was doing all the work to put the blog post out on this today. Amazon and Audible work together, of course, and they have a thing called WhisperSync. And this might be useful even if you don't want this book for other books. If you buy the Kindle first on a book that has WhisperSync, you're going to get a discount on the Audible. And the two apps, the Kindle app and the Audible app, and this is across multiple devices and all, stay in sync. So if you read to, let's say, page 30, you know, and then you quit reading, then what's going to happen is when you pull the audiobook up, it's going to come maybe a few sentences before where you stopped reading and start there. And then if you stop listening to the audiobook on a place where it would end up like on page 60 of the Kindle, it's going to start like the last two sentences of page 59 on the Kindle. So that you can read and listen all the way through the book. If you have times where maybe you can't listen but you can read, or you can read but you can't listen. So that would be just something good to know, and you might want to start checking that. Now, I would say this. This book is pretty inexpensive since it's old, and things like that you may want to save for more expensive audiobooks. That's up to you, more expensive Kindle books, because this thing is really, really affordable because it's old. The hard copy, when I say hard copy, I mean like a hard cover, is like $16. The book itself, the soft cover, is like $5.99. So I also think if you have an entrepreneur, someone that's in the business leadership, mentorship, someone who collects books like this and they don't have this book, what a great Christmas present. But if you're going to do that, you've got somebody that has a bookshelf, buy them the hardcover. I mean, I just prefer hardcovers on my bookshelf. I'll just say that. Even though I mostly listen to audio and read ebooks today, when I have a book that I really want long term, that's when I go out and I'll buy the hard copy, even if I have another version of it. Anyway, with that, hope you guys enjoyed today's show. I had a good time with it, and I'll be back next week and we'll do it all again. And I just got a suggestion from a listener. And I already reached out to Chef Ken Daniels, and we've already agreed we're going to do this. I just ain't figured out the date yet. But we're coming up on my favorite time of year, which is Christmas. I love the holidays as a whole, Thanksgiving through New Year's, but Christmas is, honest to God, my favorite time of year. It really is. And that's when we get together with family and friends, and we have meals. And we had Ken on for a Thanksgiving meal, and I had a listener say, what about bringing Ken on to talk about a Christmas meal? And what we're going to do, the one thing I'm going to make sure that we both agree with, we're not going to talk turkey. We did turkey. If you want turkey for Christmas, you can go back to listen to the advice on that. We're talking about everything else with a Christmas meal. So we'll talk about some other centerpieces, like maybe a standing rib roast or a ham or some other things that you can do that are a little bit different than just another big old bird. Not there's anything wrong with a big old bird. Anyway, that's going to be coming up. I'm going to give you my estimate here. If it works for Ken, I think we're going to do this Wednesday next week, the 17th. I had thought about pushing out to the 22nd, which, by the way, that's the day the ChatGPT course goes on sale, 100 and done until, you know, 8 weeks later. If you want to take it, this is the time to make it happen. But if we do that, you only have a few days till Christmas Day. And a lot of people do kind of their Christmas meal on the Christmas Eve. So I don't want to push, or, you know, maybe some people will do it the 26th this year because it's the Friday after Christmas. Some people do it Christmas Day, what have you. So either way, the 22nd doesn't give you a lot of time to gather some things you might want to add or what have you. And everything's crazy that week as far as going to the store, even the grocery store or something. So if we do it the 17th, that's a Wednesday. You got a Thursday, a Friday, a full weekend, and then the lead up that week. So I think that's what we're going to do. As long as Ken's available on Wednesday the 17th, that's what we'll do. With that, guys, take care. I appreciate you guys tuning in as always. And have a great day and a great weekend, since I won't talk to you again until Monday.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.